I felt cold as I hurried down the dark driveway toward the gate. Fido, the security guard, was waiting for me at the front gate and passed back my knife and my cane without a word. A tow truck was out in front, latching itself to the Beetle. I put one hand on the cold metal of the gate and kept the other, with its handkerchief pressed to my throat, and watched George, the tow truck guy, work. He recognized me and waved, flashing a grin that showed the white teeth in his dark face. I nodded back. I wasn't up to answering the smile. A few minutes later, the guard's cellular phone beeped at him. He withdrew several paces, repeated several affirmatives, then took a notebook from his pocket, writing something down. He put the phone away and walked back over to me, offering me the piece of paper. "What's this?" I said. "The phone number you were looking for, and a message." I glanced at the paper but avoided reading it just then. I thought Bianca was going to send Paula down with it. He didn't say anything, but his jaw tightened, and I saw his eyes flick toward the house where his mistress was. He swallowed. Paula wasn't coming out of the house, and Fido was afraid. I took the paper. I kept my hand from shaking as I looked at it. On it was a phone number and a single word: regret. I folded the piece of paper in half and put it away into the pocket of my duster. Another enemy. Super. At least with my hands in my pockets, Fido couldn't see them shaking. Maybe I should have listened to Murphy. Maybe I should have stayed home and played with some nice, safe, forbidden black magic instead.
Please insert the next CD to continue the story.
I departed Bianca's place in George's Loner, a wood-paneled Studebaker that grumbled and growled and squealed everywhere it went. I stopped at a payphone, short distance from the house, and called Linda Randall's number. The phone rang several times before a quiet, dusty contralto answered.
"Beckett, this is Linda."
"Linda Randall?" I asked.
"Mm-hmm,"
she answered. She had a furry, velvety voice, something tactile.
"Who's this?"
"My name is Harry Dresden, and I was wondering if I could talk to you."
"Harry who?"
she asked. "Dresden. I'm a private investigator." She laughed, a sound rich enough to roll around naked in.
"Investigating my privates, Mr. Dresden. I like you already."
I coughed. Yes, Ms. Randall.
"Miss," she said, cutting in. "Miss Randall, I'm not occupied at the moment."
"Miss Randall," I amended. "I'd like to ask you some questions about Jennifer Stanton, if I could." Silence on the other end of the line. I could hear some sounds in the background, a radio playing, perhaps, and a recorded voice talking about white zones and red zones and loading and unloading of vehicles. "Miss Randall?"
"No,"
she said. "It won't take long, and I assure you that you aren't the subject of anything I'm doing. If you could just give me a few moments of your time."
"No," she told me. "I'm on duty and will be for the rest of the night. I don't have time for this."
"Jennifer Stanton was a friend of yours. She's been murdered. If there's anything you can tell me that might help..." She cut me off again.
"There isn't," she said. "Goodbye, Mr. Dresden."
The line went dead. I scowled at the phone, frustrated. That was it then. I'd gone through all the preparation, the face-off with Bianca and possible future troubling for nothing. No way, I thought. No way in hell. Bianca had said that Linda Randall was working as a driver for someone. The Becketts, I presume, whoever they were. I recognized the voice in the background as a recorded message that played outside the concourses at O'Hare Airport. So she was in a car at the airport, maybe waiting to pick up the Becketts, and definitely not here for long. With no time to lose, I kicked the wheezing old Studebaker into gear and drove to O'Hare. It was far easier to blow off someone over the phone than it was to do it in person. There were several concourses, but I had to trust to luck. Luck to guide me to the right one. And luck to get me there in time before Miss I Am Not Occupied Randall had the opportunity to pick up her employers and leave. And a little more luck to keep the Studebaker running all the way to O'Hare. The Studebaker did make it all the way there. And on the second concourse, I came across a silvery baby limo idling in a parking zone. The interior was darkened, so I couldn't see inside very well. It was a Friday evening, and the place was busy. Business folk in their sober suits returning home from long trips about the country. Cars continually purring in and out of the semicircular drive. A uniformed cop was directing traffic, keeping people from doing brainless things like parking in the middle of one of the traffic lanes in order to load up the car. I swerved the old Studebaker into a parking place. racing a Volvo for it and winning by a dint of driving the older and heavier vehicle and having the more suicidal attitude. I kept an eye on the silver limo as I got out of the car and strode over to a bank of payphones. I plopped my quarter in and once more dialed the number provided by Bianca. The phone rang. In the silver limo, someone stirred. "Beckett's, this is Linda," she purred. "Hello, Linda," I said. "This is Harry Dresden again." I could almost hear her smirk. There was a flicker of light from inside the car, the silhouette of a woman's face, and then the orange glow of a cigarette being lit.
"I thought I told you I didn't want to talk to you, Mr. Dresden."
"I like women who play hard to get." She laughed that delicious laugh. I could see her head move in the darkened car when she did.
"I'm getting harder to get by the second. Goodbye again."
She hung up on me. I smiled, hung up the phone, walked over to the limo, and rapped on the window. It buzzed down. A woman in her mid-20s arched an eyebrow at me. She had beautiful eyes, the color of rain clouds, and a little too much eyeshadow, and brilliant scarlet lipstick on her Cupid's bow lips. Her hair was medium brown, drawn back into a tight braid that made her cheeks look almost sharp, severe, except for her forelocks, which hung down close to her eyes in an insolent disarray. She had a predatory look about her, harsh, sharp. She wore a crisp white shirt, gray slacks, and held a lit cigarette in one hand. The smoke curled up around my nose, and I exhaled, trying to push it away. She looked me up and down, frankly assessing.
"Don't tell me. Harry Dresden."
"I really need to talk to you, Miss Randall. It won't take long." She glanced at her watch, and then at the terminal doors. Then back up at me.
"Well, you've got me cornered, don't you? I'm at your mercy."
Her lips quirked. She took a drag of her cigarette. "And I like a man who just won't stop." I cleared my throat again. The woman was attractive, but not unduly so. Yet there was just something about her that revved my engines. Something about the way she held her head or shaped her words that bypassed my brain and went straight to my hormones. Best to head directly to the point and minimize my chances of looking moronic. "How do you know Jennifer Stanton?" She looked up at me through long lashes. "Intimately." You worked for Bianca with her?" Linda blew more smoke.
"That prissy little bitch. Yes, I worked with Jen. We were even roommates for a while. Shared a bed."
She wrapped her lips around the last word, drawing it out with a little tremor that dipped wicked secret laughter. "Did you know Tommy Tom?" I asked.
"Oh, sure, fantastic in bed."
She lowered her eyes and shifted on the car's seat, lowering one of her hands out of sight and made me wonder where it had gone.
"He was a regular customer, maybe twice a month. Jen and I would go over to his place, have a little party."
She leaned towards me.
"He could do things to a woman that would turn her into a real animal, Harry Dresden. You know what I mean? Growling and snarling in heat."
She was driving me crazy. That voice of hers inspired the kinds of dreams you wish you could remember more clearly in the morning. Her expression promised to show me things that you don't talk about with other people if I would give her half a chance. "Your job, Harry, think about your job. Sometimes I really hate my job." "When was the last time you talked to her?" She took another drag, and this time I saw a small shake to her fingers, one she quickly hid, just not quickly enough. She was nervous. Nervous enough to be shaking. And now I could see what she was up to. She was wearing the alley cat mask, appealing to my glands instead of my brain, and trying to distract me with it, trying to keep me from finding something out. I'm not inhuman. I can be distracted by a pretty face or body, like any other youngish man. Linda Randall was damned good at playing the part, but I do not like to be made the fool. "So, Miss Sex Goddess, what are you hiding?" I cleared my throat and asked mildly, "When was the last time you spoke to Jennifer Stanton, Miss Randall?" She narrowed her eyes at me. She wasn't dumb, whatever else she was. She'd seen me reading her, seeing through her pretense. The flirting manner vanished. "Are you a cop?" she demanded. I shook my head. "Scout's honor. I'm just trying to find out what happened to her." She said softly. She flicked the butt of the cigarette out onto the concrete and blew out a mouthful of smoke.
Look, I tell you anything and I see a cop coming around. I never saw you before. You got it? I nodded. I talked to Jen on Wednesday evening. She called me. It was Tommy's birthday. She wanted to get together again. Her mouth twisted. Sort of a reunion. I glanced about and then leaned down closer to her. Did you? Her eyes were roving about now, nervous, like a cat who has found herself shut into a small room. No, she said. I had to work. I wanted to, but... Did she say anything unusual? Anything that might have made you suspect she was in danger? She shook her head again. No, nothing. We hadn't talked much for a while. I didn't see her as much after I split from the Velvet Room. I frowned at her. Do you know what else she was doing? Anything that she might have been involved with that could have gotten her hurt? She shook her head. No, no, nothing like that. That wasn't her style. She was sweet. A lot of girls get like... They get pretty jaded, Mr. Dresden, but it never really touched her. She made people feel better about themselves somehow. She looked away. I could never do that. All I did was get them off. There's nothing you can tell me, nothing you can think of. She pressed her lips together and shook her head. She shook her head and she lied to me as she did it. I was sure of it. She was closing in, tightening up. And if there was nothing to tell me, she wouldn't be trying to hide it. She must know something, unless she was just shutting down because I'd stomped all over her feelings, as I had Bianca's. Either way, she wasn't telling me anything else. I tightened my fist, frustrated. If Linda Randall had no information for me, I was at a dead end. And I'd romped all over another woman's feelings. Two in one night, you are on a roll, Dresden. Even if one of them had been a non-human. Why? I asked her, the words slipping out before I thought about them. Why the slut act? She looked up at me again and smirked. I saw the subtle shifting in her, magnifying that sort of animal appeal she had once more, as she had been doing when I first approached her, but it didn't hide the self-loathing in her eyes. I looked away quickly before I could see any more of it. I got the feeling I didn't want to see Linda Randall's soul. Because that's what I do, Mr. Dresden. For some people, it's drugs, booze. For me, orgasms, sex, passion. Just another addict. City's full of them. She glanced aside. Next best thing to love. And it keeps me in work. Excuse me. She swung open the door. I took a quick step back out of her way, and she moved back to the limo, long legs taking long steps, and opened the trunk. A tall couple, both wearing glasses and dressed in stylish gray business clothes, emerged from the terminal and approached the limo. They had the look of lifestyle professionals, the kind that have a career and no kids, with enough money and time to spend on making themselves look good. A Nordic track couple. He was carrying an overnight bag over his shoulder and a small suitcase in one hand, and while she bore only a briefcase. They wore no jewelry, not even watches or wedding rings. Odd. The man slung the luggage items into the limo's trunk and looked from Linda to me. Linda avoided his eyes. He tried to speak quietly enough not to be heard, but I have good ears. "Who's this?" he asked. His voice had a strained note to it. "Just a friend, Mr. Beckett, a guy I used to see," she answered him. More lies. More interesting. I looked across the limo to the woman, presumably Mrs. Beckett. She regarded me with a calm face, entirely void of emotion. It was a little spooky. She had the look I'd seen in films, on the faces of prisoners released from the German Stalags in the end of World War II. Empty, numb, dead, and just didn't know it yet. Linda opened the back door and let Mr. and Mrs. Beckett into the car. Mrs. Beckett briefly put a hand on Linda's waist in passing, a gesture that was too intimate and possessive for the hired help. I saw Linda shiver, then close the door. She walked back around the car to me. "Get out of here," she said quietly. "I don't want to get in any trouble with my boss." I reached for her hand, grabbed it, and held it between both of mine, as a lover might, I supposed. My business card was pressed between our palms. "My card. If you think of anything else, give me a call, okay?" She turned away from me without answering, but the card vanished into a pocket before she got back into the limo. Mrs. Beckett's dead eyes watched me through the side window as the limo went by. It was my turn to shiver. Like I said, spooky. I went on into the airport, the monitors displaying flight times flickering to fuzz as I walked by. I went to one of the cafes inside, sat down, and ordered myself a cup of coffee. I had to pay for it with change.
Most of my money had gone into paying off last month's rent and into the love potion I'd let Bob talk me into making. Money. I needed to get to work on Monica Sells' case, finding her husband. I didn't want to get out of hot water with the White Council, only to lose my office and apartment because I couldn't pay the bills. I sipped my coffee and tried to organize my thoughts. I had two areas of concern. The most important was finding out who had killed Tommy Tom and Jennifer Stanton. Not only to catch the killer before any more corpses turned up, but because if I didn't, the White Council would probably use the opportunity to have me put to death. And, while tracking down killers and avoiding execution squads, I had to do some work for someone who would pay me. Tonight's excursion wasn't something I could charge Murphy for. She'd have my ass in a sling if she knew I was running around asking questions, poking my nose in where it shouldn't be. So, if I wanted money from Chicago PD, I would have to spend time doing the research Murphy wanted. Black magic research that could get me killed all by itself. Or I could work on Monica Sells' missing husband case. I thought I had that one pretty well pegged down, but it wouldn't hurt to get it fleshed out fully. I could spend time working on it, filling out the hours on the retainer, maybe even getting a few more added on. That appealed to me a lot more than trying to work out some black magic. So I could follow up on the lead Toot Toot had given me. There'd been pizza delivered out to the Lake Providence home that night. Time to talk to the delivery man, if possible. I left the cafe, went out to the payphones, and dialed directory assistance. There was only one place near to the Lake Providence address that delivered pizza. I got the number and dialed through.
Pizza Express,
someone with a mouthful said.
What'll it be tonight?
Hey there, I said. I wonder if you can help me out. I'm looking for the driver who took an order out to an address on Wednesday night. I told him the address and asked if he could help me speak to the driver.
Another one, he snorted. Sure, hang on. Jack's just got in from a run.
The voice on the other end of the line called out to someone, and a minute later the high baritone of a young man spoke tentatively into my ear.
Hello?
Hello, I answered. Are you the driver who took the pizza to...
Look, he said, his voice exasperated and nervous. I said I was sorry already. It won't happen again.
I blinked for a minute, off balance.
Sorry for what?
Jesus, he said. I heard him move across the room with a lot of music and loud talk in the background, and in the background noise cut off as though he'd stepped into another room and shut the door behind him.
Look, he said in a half whine, I told you I'm not going to say anything to anyone. I was only looking. You can't blame me, right? No one answered the door, so what was I supposed to do?
His voice cracked in the middle of the sentences.
It's a hell of a party, but hey, that's your business, right?
I struggled to keep up with the kid. What exactly did you see, Jack? I asked him.
No one's face,
he assured me, his voice growing more nervous. He gave a jittery little laugh and tried to joke.
Better things to look at than faces, right? I mean, I don't give a damn what you do in your own house, or your friends, or whatever. Don't worry about me. Never gonna say a thing. Next time, I'll just leave the pizza and run a tab, right?
Friends. Plural. Interesting. The kid was awfully nervous. He must have gotten an eyeful. But I had a gut instinct that he was hiding something else, keeping it back.
What else?
I asked him. I kept my voice calm and neutral. You saw something else. What was it?
None of my business, he said instantly. None of my business. Look, I gotta get off this line. We have to keep it open for orders. It's Friday night. We're busy as hell.
What, I said, separating my words and keeping them clipped, else?
Oh, shit,
he breathed, his voice shaking.
Look, I wasn't with that guy. Don't know anything about him. I didn't tell him you were having an orgy out there, honest. Jesus, mister, I don't want any trouble.
Victor Sells seemed to have a real good idea of how to party. And of how to frighten teenagers.
One more question, I'll let this go, I told him. Who was it you saw? Tell me about him. I don't know him. I didn't recognize him. Some guy with a camera, that's all. I went around to the back of the house to try the back door, got up on your deck, and just saw inside. I didn't keep on looking, but there he was up there, all in black, with his camera taking pictures.
He paused as someone pounded on the door he had earlier closed.
Oh, God. I have to go, mister. I don't know you. I don't know nothing.
And then there was a scrambling of feet as he hung up the phone. I hung up the phone myself and ambled back to George's loner. I worked out details I had just learned on the way back to my apartment.
Someone else had called Pizza Express, apparently just before I had. Someone else had gone asking after the pizza boy. Who? Why, Victor Sells, of course. Tracing down people who might have information about him. His possible presence in the lake house. Victor Sells, who had been having some sort of get-together out there that night. Maybe he'd been drunk, or one of his guests had, and ordered a pizza. And now Victor was trying to cover his tracks. Which implied that Victor knew someone was looking for him. Hell, as far as I knew, he'd been in the house when I'd gone out there last night. This made things a lot more interesting. A missing man, who doesn't want to be found, could get dangerous if someone came snooping after him. And a photographer. Someone lurking around outside of the windows and taking pictures. I rummaged in my duster's pocket and found the round plastic film canister. That explained where that had come from, at any rate. But why would someone be out there in the house taking pictures of Victor and his friends? Maybe because Monica had hired someone else, a PI, without telling me. Maybe just a neighbor with the hots for taking dirty pictures. No way to tell, really. More mysteries. I pulled the Studebaker into my drive and killed the engine. I tallied the score for the evening. Enigma's lots, Harry, zero. My investigation for Monica Sells had netted me one husband throwing wild parties in his beach house after losing his job and working hard not to be found. Probably an advanced case of male menopause. Monica didn't seem to be the kind of woman who would take such a thing with good grace, more like the kind who would close her eyes and call me a liar if I told her the truth. But at least it merited a little more looking into. I could log a few more hours in on the case, maybe earn a little more money out of it before I gave her the bill. But I still didn't really know anything. The angle with Bianca had come to a dead end at Linda Randall. All I had were more questions for Miss Randall, and she was as closed as a bank on Sunday. I didn't have anything solid enough to hand to Murphy to let her pursue the matter. Damn it. I was going to have to do that research after all. Maybe it would turn up something helpful, some kind of clue to help me and the police find the murderer. And maybe dragons would fly out of my butt. But I had to try. So I got out of the car to go inside and get to work. He was waiting for me behind the trash cans that stood next to the stairs leading down to my front door. The baseball bat he swung at me took me behind the ear and pitched me to the bottom of the stairs in a near senseless heap. I could hear his footsteps but couldn't quite move as he came down the stairs toward me. It figured it was just the kind of day I was having. I felt his foot on the back of my neck, felt him lift the baseball bat, and then it came whistling down towards my skull with a mighty crack of impact. Except that it missed my motionless head and whacked into the concrete next to my face, right by my eyes instead. "Listen up, Dresden," my attacker said. His voice was rough, low, purposefully hoarse. "You got a big nose. Stop sticking it where it doesn't belong. You got a big mouth. Stop talking to people you don't need to talk to. Or maybe we're going to shut that mouth of yours." He waited a melodramatically appropriate moment and then added, "Permanently." His footsteps retreated up the stairs and vanished. I just lay there, watching the stars in front of my eyes for a while. Mister appeared from somewhere, probably drawn by the groaning noises, and started licking at my nose. I eventually regained my mobility and sat up. My head was spinning, and I felt sick to my stomach. Mister rubbed up against me, as though he sensed something was wrong, purring in a low rumble. I managed to stand up enough to unlock my apartment door, let Mister and myself in, and lock the door behind me. I staggered over to my easy chair in the darkness and sat down with a woof of expelled breath. I sat motionless until the spinning slowed down enough to allow me to open my eyes again, and until the pounding of my head slowed down. Pounding head. Someone could have been pounding on my head with a baseball bat just then. Pounding my head into new and interesting shapes that were inconducive to carrying on business-like pursuits. Someone could have been pounding Harry Dresden right into the hereafter. I cut off that line of thought. "You are not some poor rabbit, Dresden," I reminded myself sternly. "You are a wizard of the old school, a spell's linger of the highest caliber. You're not going to roll over for some schmuck with a baseball bat just because he tells you to." Galvanized by the sound of my own voice, or maybe only by the somewhat unsettling realization that I had begun talking to myself, I stood up and built a fire in the fireplace,
then walked unsteadily back and forth in front of it, trying to think, to work out the details. Had this evening's visits triggered the warning? Who had reason to threaten me? What were they trying to keep me from finding? And most importantly, what was I going to do about it? Someone had seen me talking to Linda Randall, maybe. Or more likely, someone had seen me showing up at Bianca's place, asking questions. The Blue Beetle may not be glitzy, but it was sort of difficult to mistake for anyone else's car. Who would have reason to have me watched? Why? Had gentleman Johnny Marconi followed me so that he could have a word with me? So he could ask me to keep out of this business with Tommy Tom's murder? Yes, he had. Maybe this had been another reminder from the mod boss. It had that kind of mafioso feel to it. I staggered to my kitchenette and fixed myself a Tisson tea for the headache, then added in some aspirin. Herbal remedies are well and good, but I don't like to take chances. Working on that same principle, I got my Smith & Wesson 38 Chief Special out of its drawer, took the cloth covering off of it and made sure it was loaded. Then I stuck the revolver in my jacket pocket. Wizardry aside, it's tough to beat a gun for discouraging men with baseball bats. And I sure as hell wasn't going to roll over for the tiger-souled Johnny Marconi. Let him push me around. Let him know it was all right to walk all over me whenever he felt like it. No way in hell. Or on Earth, either. My head was throbbing and my hands were shaking. But I went down the ladder to my workroom and started figuring out how to rip someone's heart out of his chest from 50 miles away. Who says I never do anything fun on Friday night? It took me the rest of the night and part of the rest of the morning, but I worked out how I could murder someone in the same manner that Tommy Tom and Jennifer Stanton had been killed. After the fifth or sixth time I checked the figures, I stared at my calculations. It didn't make any sense. It was impossible. Or maybe we were all underestimating just how dangerous this killer was. I grabbed my duster and headed out without bothering to check my books. I don't keep any mirrors in my home. Too many things can use mirrors as windows or doors. But I was pretty sure I looked like a wreck. The Studebaker's rearview mirror confirmed this. My face was haggard, with a shadow of beard, deep circles under bloodshot eyes, and hair that looked as though it had been riding a speeding motorcycle through a cloud of greasy smoke. Smoothing your hair back with sweaty palms as a study habit will do that to you, especially if you do it for 12 or 14 hours straight. It didn't matter. Murphy wanted this information, and she needed to have it. Things were bad. They were very, very bad. I made quick time down to the station, knowing Murphy would want to hear this from me face to face. The police station Murphy worked in was one in an aged complex of buildings that housed the Metro Police Department. It was run down, sagging in places like an old soldier who nonetheless stood at attention and struggled to hold in his gut. There was graffiti along one wall that the janitor wouldn't come to scrub off until Monday morning. I parked in the visitor's parking, easy to do on a Saturday morning, and headed up the steps and into the building. The desk sergeant wasn't the usual mustached old warhorse who I had run into before, but a graying matron with steely eyes who disapproved of me and my lifestyle in a single glance, then made me wait while she called up Murphy. While I waited, a pair of officers came in, dragging a handcuffed man between them. He wasn't resisting them, just the opposite, in fact. His head was thrown down and he was moaning in an almost musical way. He was on the thin side, but I got the impression he was young. His denim jeans and jacket were battered, unkempt, as was his hair. That DUI we called in. We're going to take him up to holding until he can see straight. The desk sergeant passed a clipboard over, and one of the officers took it under his arm before the two of them dragged the young man up the stairs. I waited, rubbing at my tired eyes, until the sergeant managed to get through to someone upstairs. She gave a rather surprised, "Huh?" and then said, "All right, Lieutenant, I'll send him on up." She waved a hand at me to go on past. I could feel her eyes on me as I went by, and I smoothed my palm self-consciously over my head and jaw. Special Investigations kept a little waiting area just within the door at the top of the staircase. It consisted of four wooden chairs and a sagging old couch that would probably kill your back if you tried to sleep on it. Murphy's office was at the end of a double row of cubicles. Murphy stood inside her office with a phone pressed to her ear, wearing a martyred expression. She looked like a teenager having a fight with her out-of-town boyfriend, though she'd tear my head off if she heard me saying any such thing.
I waved my hand, and she nodded back at me. She pointed at the waiting area and then shut her office door. I took a seat in one of the chairs and leaned my head back against the wall. I had just closed my eyes when I heard a scream from behind me in the hallway. There was a struggling sound and a few startled exclamations before the scream repeated itself, closer this time. I acted without thinking. I was too tired to think. I rose and went into the hall, towards the source of the sound. To my left was the staircase going, and to my right was the hallway stretched ahead of me. A figure appeared, a silhouette of a running man, moving towards me in long strides. It was the man who had hung so limply between the two officers, humming a few minutes before. He was the one screaming. I heard a scrabbling sound, and then the pair of officers I had seen downstairs a few moments before came around the corner. Neither one of them was a young man anymore, and they both ran with their bellies out, puffing for breath, holding their gun belts against their hips with one hand. "Stop!" said one of the officers, panting. "Stop that man!" The hair on the back of my neck prickled. The man running towards me kept on screaming, high and terrified, his voice a long and uninterrupted peal of something. Terror, panic, lust, rage, all rolled up into a ball and sent spewing out into the air through his vocal cords. I had a quick impression of wide, staring eyes and a dirty face, a denim jacket and old jeans as he came down the shadowy hallway. His hands were behind his back, presumably held there by cuffs. He wasn't seeing the hall he was running through. I don't know what he was looking at, but I got the impression I didn't want to know. He came hurtling towards me and the stairs, blind and dangerous to himself. It wasn't any of my business, but I couldn't let him break himself apart in a tumble down the stairs. I threw myself toward him as hard as I could, attempting to put my shoulder into his stomach and drive him backwards in a football-style tackle. There is a reason I got cut every year during high school. I rammed into him, but he just whuffed out of breath and spun to one side into a wall. It was as though he hadn't seen me coming and had no realization I was there. He just kept staring blindly and screaming, careening off the wall, and continuing on his way toward the stairs. I went down to the floor, my head abruptly throbbing again where the unknown tough had wrapped me with a baseball bat last night. One good thing about being as tall as I am, I have long arms. I rolled back toward him and lashed out with one hand, fingers clutching. I caught his jeans at the cuff and gave his leg a solid sideways tug. That did it. He spun, off-balanced, and went down to the tile floor. The scream stopped as the fall took the wind out of him. He slid to the top of the stairs and stopped, feebly struggling. The officers pounded past me towards him, one going to either side. And then something strange happened. The young man looked at me, his eyes rounded and dilated, until I thought they had turned into huge black coins, dotted onto his bloodshot eyeballs. His eyes rolled back into his head until he could hardly have been able to see, and he started to shout in a clarion voice, "Wizard!" he trumpeted. "Wizard! I see you! I see you, wizard! I see things that follow! Those who've walked before, and he who walks behind! They come for you!" "Christ on a crutch," the shorter, rounder officer said, as they took the man by his arms and dragged him back down the hall. "Junkies, thanks for the assist, buddy." I stared at the man, stunned. I caught the sleeve of the other officer. "What's going on, sir?" I asked him. He stopped, letting the prisoner hang behind him and his partner. The prisoner's head was bowed forward and his eyes were still rolled back, but he had his head turned toward me and was grinning a horrible, toothy grin. His forehead was wrinkled oddly, almost as though he were somehow focusing on me through the bones of his brow ridges and the frontal lobes of his brain. "Junkie," the taller officer said. "One of those new three-eye punks caught him down by the lake in his car with nearly 4 grams of the stuff. Probably more in him." He shook his head. "You okay?" "Fine, fine," I assured him. "Three-eye, that new drug?" A shorter officer snorted. "One that's supposed to make them see the spirit world, that kind of crap." The taller one nodded. "Stuff hooks harder than crack. Thanks for the help. I didn't know you were a civilian, though. Didn't expect anyone but police down here this time of day." "No problem," I assured him. "I'm fine." "Hey," the stouter one said. He squinted at me and shook his finger. "Aren't you that guy, that psychic consultant Carmichael told me about?" "I'll take the fifth," I said to him with a grin that I didn't feel. The two officers chuckled and turned back to their business, quickly shouldering me aside as they dragged their prisoner away. He whispered in a mad little voice all the way down the hall, see you, wizard, see he who walks behind. I returned to my chair in the waiting area at the end of the row of cubicles and sat down, my head throbbing, my stomach rolling uncomfortably. He who walks behind. I had never seen the junkie before, never been close to him. I hadn't sensed the subtle tension of power in the air around him that signified the presence of a magical practitioner. So how the hell had he seen the shadow of he who walks behind flowing in my wake? For reasons I don't have time to go into now, I am marked, indelibly, with the remnants of the presence of a hunter spirit, a sort of spectral hitman known as he who walks behind. I had beaten long odds in surviving the enemy of mine who had called up he who walks behind and sent him after me, but even though the hunter spirit had never gotten to me, the mark could still be seen upon me by those who knew how, by using the third sight, stretching out behind me like a long and horribly shaped shadow, sort of a spiritual scar to remind me of the encounter. But only a wizard had that kind of vision, the ability to sense the auras and manifestations of magical phenomena. And that junkie had been no wizard. Was it possible that I'd been wrong in my initial assessment of Three Eye? Could the drug genuinely grant its users the visions of the third sight? I shuddered at the thought. The kind of things you see when you learn how to open your third eye could be blindingly beautiful, bring tears to your eyes, or they could be horrible. Things that made your worst nightmares seem ordinary and comforting. Visions of the past, the future, of the true natures of things. Psychic stains, troubled shades, spirit folk of all description. The shivering power of the never-never in all its brilliant and subtle hues, and all going straight into your brain, unforgettable, permanent. Wizards quickly learn how to control the third eye, to keep it closed, except in times of great need, or else they go mad within a few weeks. I shivered. If the drug was real, if it really did open the third eye in mortals instead of just inflicting ordinary hallucinations upon its users, then it was far more dangerous than it seemed. Even with the deleterious effects demonstrated by the junkie I had tackled. Even if the user didn't go mad after seeing too many horrible or otherworldly things, he might see through the illusions and disguises of any of a number of beings that passed among mankind regularly unseen, which could compel such creatures to act in defense for fear of being revealed. Double jeopardy. Dresden, Murphy snapped. Wake up. I blinked. Not asleep. I slurred, just resting my eyes. She snorted. Save it, Harry, and pushed a styrofoam cup into my hands. She made me coffee with a ton of sugar in it, just the way I like. And even though it was a little stale, it smelled like heaven. You're an angel, I muttered. I took a sip and then nodded down a row of cubicles. You want to hear this one in your office? I could feel her eyes on me as I drank. All right, she said, let's go. And the coffee's 50 cents, Harry. I followed her to her office, a hastily assembled thing with cheap plywood walls and a door that isn't hung quite right. The door had a paper sign taped to it, neatly lettered in black magic marker with Lieutenant Karen Murphy. There was a rectangle of lighter wood where a plaque had once held some other hapless policeman's name. That the office never bothered to put up a fresh plaque was a not-so-subtle reminder of the precarious position of the Special Investigations Director. Her office furniture, the entire interior of the office, in fact, was a contrast with the outside. Her desk and chair were sleek, dark, and new. Her PC was always on and running, with its own desk set immediately to her left. A bulletin board covered most of one wall, and current cases were neatly organized on it. Her college diploma, the Aikido trophies, and her marksman's awards were on the wall to one's immediate right as you entered the office, and sitting there right next to your face if you were standing before her desk or sitting in the chair in front of it. It was Murphy, organized, direct, determined, and just a little bit belligerent. Hold it, Murphy told me. I stopped outside of her office, as I always did, while she went inside and turned off, then unplugged her computer and the small radio on her desk. Murphy is used to the kind of mayhem that happens whenever I get around machinery. After she was done, I went on in.
I sat down and slurped more coffee. She slid up onto the edge of her desk, looking down at me, her blue eyes narrowed. She was dressed no less casually on a Saturday than she was on a work day. Dark slacks, a dark blouse, set off by her golden hair and bright silver necklace and earrings. Very stylish. I, in my rumpled sweats and t-shirt, black duster and muscled hair, felt very slouchy. "All right, Harry," she said. "What have you got for me?" I took one last drink of coffee, stifled a yawn, and put the cup down on her desk. She slipped a coaster under it as I started speaking. "I was up all night working on it," I said, keeping my voice soft. "I had a hell of a time figuring out the spell. And as near as I can figure it, it's almost impossible to do with one person, let alone two at once." She glared at me. "Don't tell me almost impossible. I've got two corpses that say otherwise." "Keep your shirt on," I growled at her. "I'm just getting started. You gotta understand the whole thing if you're gonna understand any of it." Her glare intensified. She put her hands on the edge of her desk and said in a deadly, reasonable tone, "All right, why don't you explain it to me?" I rubbed my eyes again. "Look, whoever did this did it with a thaumaturgic spell. That much I'm sure of. He or she used some of Tommy Tom and Jennifer Stan's hair or fingernails or something to create a link to them. Then they ripped out a symbolic heart from some kind of ritual doll or sacrificial animal and used a whale of amount of energy to make the same thing happen to the victims. This doesn't tell me anything new, Harry." I'm getting there, I said. "The amount of energy you need to do this thing is staggering. It would be a lot easier to manage a small earthquake than to affect a living being like that. Best case scenario, I might be able to do it without killing myself. To one person who had really, really pissed me off." "You're naming yourself as a suspect?" Murphy's mouth quirked at the corner. I snorted. "I said I was strong enough to do it to one person. I think it would kill me to try, too." "You're saying that some sort of wizard version of Arnold Schwarzenegger pulled this off?" I shrugged. "It's possible, I suppose. More likely, someone who's just really good pulled it off. Raw power doesn't determine all that you can do with magic. Focus matters, too. The better your focus is, the better you are at putting your power in one place at the same time, the more you can get done. Sort of like when you see some ancient little Chinese martial arts master shatter a tree trunk with his hands. He couldn't lift a puppy over his head, but he can focus what power he does have with incredible effect." Murphy glanced at her Aikido trophies and nodded. "Okay," she said. "I can understand that, I think. So we're looking for a wizard version of Mr. Miyagi?" "Or," I said, lifting a finger, "more than one wizard worked on this at the same time, pooled their power together and used it all at once." My pounding head combined with the queasy stomach and the caffeine was making me a little woozy. Teamwork, that's what counts. "Multiple killers," Murphy drawled. "I don't have one, and now you're telling me there might be 50. 13, I corrected her. "You can never use more than 13. But I don't think that's very likely. It's a bitch to do. Everyone in the circle has to be committed to the spell, have no doubts, no reservations, and they have to trust one another implicitly. You don't see that kind of thing from your average gang of killers. It just isn't something that's going to happen, outside of some kind of fanaticism. A cult or a political organization." "A cult," Murphy said. She rubbed at her eyes. "The Arcane is going to have a field day with this one if it gets out. So Bianca is involved in this after all. Surely she's got enough enemies out there who could do this. She could inspire that kind of effort to get rid of her." I shook my head. The pain was getting worse, heavier, but pieces were falling into place. "No, you're thinking the wrong angle here. The killer wasn't taking out a hooker and Tommy Tom to get at Bianca." "How do you know?" "I went to see her," I responded. "Damn it, Harry!" I didn't react to her angry. "You know she wasn't going to talk to you, Murph. She's an old-fashioned monster girl. No cooperation with the authorities." "But she did talk to you," Murphy demanded. I said, "Pretty please." "I would beat the crap out of you if you didn't already look like it," Murphy said. "What did you find out?" "Bianca wasn't in on it. She didn't have a clue who it could have been. She was nervous, scared. I didn't mention that she'd been scared enough to try to take me to pieces. So someone sending a message, but not to Bianca." "To Johnny Marconi," I confirmed. "Gang war in the streets," Murphy said.
And now the outfit is bringing sorcery into it as well. Mafioso magic spells. Jesus Christ. She drummed her heels on the edge of the desk. Gang war. Three-eye suppliers versus conventional narcotics, right? She stared at me for a minute. Yeah, Murphy said. Yeah, it is. How did you know? We've been holding out details from the papers. I just ran into this guy who was stoned out of his mind on 3i. Something he said makes me think that the stuff isn't a bunch of crap. It's for real. And you would have to be one very, very badass wizard to manufacture a large quantity of this kind of drug. Murphy's blue eyes glinted. So whoever is the one supplying the streets with 3i is the one who murdered Jennifer Stanton and Tommy Tom. I'm pretty sure of it. It feels right. I tend to agree, Murphy said, nodding. All right, then. How many people do you know who could manage this kind of killing spell? Christ, Murphy, I said. You can't just ask me to hand you a list of names of people to drag downtown for questioning. She leaned closer to me, blue eyes fierce. Wrong, Harry. I can ask you. I can tell you to give them to me. And if you don't, I can haul you in for obstruction and complicity so quick it will make your head spin. My head's already spinning, I told her. A little giggle slipped out. Throbbing head, pound, pound, pound. You wouldn't do that, Murph. I know you. You know damn well that if I had anything you could use, I would give it to you. If you just let me in on the investigation, give me a chance to... No, Harry, she said, her voice flat. Not a chance. I am ass deep in alligators already without you getting difficult on me. You're already hurt, and don't ask me to buy some line about falling down the stairs. I don't want to have to scrape you off the concrete. Whoever did Tommy Tom is going to get nasty when someone comes poking around, and it isn't your job to do it. It's mine. Suit yourself, I told her. You're the one with the deadline. Her face went pale, and her eyes blazed. You are such an incredible shit, Harry. I started to answer that. I really did. But my skull got loose and shaky on my neck, and things spun around, and my chair sort of wobbled up onto its back legs and whirled around precariously. I thought it was probably safest to slide my way along to the floor, rubbery as a snake. The tiles were nice and cool underneath my cheek. It was sort of comforting. My head went boom, boom, boom the whole time I was down there, spoiling what would have been otherwise a very pleasant little nap. I woke up on the floor of Murphy's office. The clock on the wall said that it was about 20 minutes later. Something soft was underneath my head, and my feet were propped up with several phone books. Murphy was pressing a cool cloth against my forehead and throat. I felt terrible. Exhausted, achy, nauseous, my head throbbing. I wanted to do nothing so much as to curl up and whimper myself to sleep. Given that I would never live that down, I made a wisecrack instead. Do you have a little white dress? I had this deep-seated nurse fantasy about you, Murphy. A pervert like you would. Who hit your head? She demanded. No one, I mumbled, fell down the stairs to my apartment. Bullshit, Harry, she said, her voice hard. Her hands were no less gentle with the cool cloth, though. You've been running around on this case. That's where you got the bump on your head, isn't it? I started to protest. Oh, save it, she said, letting out a breath. If you didn't already have a concussion, I'd tie your heels to my car and ride through traffic. She held up two fingers. How many fingers am I holding up? 50, I said, and held up two of my own. It's not a concussion, just a little bump on the head. I'll be fine. I started to sit up. I needed to get home, get some sleep. Murphy put her hand on my neck and pressed me back down on the pillow beneath my head, which was apparently her jacket, because she wasn't wearing it. Stay down, she growled. How did you get here? Not in that heap of a car, I hope. The Beetle is doing its Phoenix impression, I told her. I've got a loner. Look, I'll be fine. Just let me out of here, and I'll go home and get some sleep. You aren't in any shape to drive, Murphy said. You're a menace. I'd have to arrest you myself if I let you behind a wheel in your condition. Murph, I said, annoyed, unless you can pay up for what you owe me already right now, I can't exactly afford a cab. Dream on, Harry, Murphy said, and save your breath. I'll give you a ride home. I don't need it, I began, but she got up from her knees and stalked out of her little office. Foolishness, I thought. Stupidity. I was perfectly capable of moving myself around, so I sat up and heaved myself to my feet. Or tried to. I actually managed to half sit up, and then I just heaved. Murphy came back in to find me curled up on my side,
her office stinking from where I'd thrown up. She didn't, for a change, say anything. She just knelt down by me again, cleaned off my mouth, and put another cool cloth over the back of my neck. I remember her helping me out to her car. I remember little pieces of the drive back to my apartment. I remember giving her the keys to the loaner and mumbling something about Mike and the tow truck driver. But mostly I remember the way her hand felt on mine. Cold, with a little bit of nervousness to the soft fingers, small beneath my great, gawking digits, and strong. She scolded and threatened me the entire way back to the apartment, I think. But I remember the way she made sure she held my hand, as though to assure herself that I was still there, or to assure me that she was there, and she wasn't going anywhere. There's a reason I'll go out on a limb to help Murphy. She's good people. One of the best. We got back to my apartment sometime before noon. Murphy helped me down the stairs and unlocked the door for me. Mister came running up and hurled himself against her legs in greeting. Maybe being short gives her better leverage or something. She didn't really wobble when Mister rammed her, like I do. Or maybe it's the Aikido. "Christ, Harry," she mumbled. "This place is dark." She tried the light switch, but the bulb had burned out last week, and I hadn't had the cash to replace them. So she set me down on the couch and lit some candles off of the glowing coals in the fireplace. "All right," she said, "I'm putting you in bed." "Well, if you insist." The phone rang. It was in arm's reach, so I picked it up. "Dresden," I mumbled. "Mr. Dresden, this is Linda. Linda Randall. Do you remember me?" "Mm-hmm." Do men remember the scene in a movie with Marilyn standing over the subway grating? I found myself remembering Linda Randall's eyes and wondering things a gentleman shouldn't. "Are you naked?" I said. It took me a minute to register what I'd said. Whoops. Murph gave me an arch look. She stood up and walked into my bedroom and busied herself straightening my covers and giving me a modicum of privacy. I felt cheered. My slip had thrown Murphy off better than any lie I could have managed. Maybe a woozy Harry was not necessarily a bad Harry. Linda purred laughter into the phone. "I'm in a car right now, honey. Maybe later. Look, I've come up with a few things that might help you. Can you meet me tonight?" I rubbed my eyes. It was Saturday. Tonight was Saturday night. Wasn't there something I was supposed to be remembering? To hell with it, I thought. It couldn't have been all that important if I couldn't even remember it. "Sure," I told her. "Fine." She mmmed into the phone. "You're such a gentleman. And I like that once in a while. I get off at 7, all right? Do you want to meet me, say at 8? "My car exploded," I said. My tongue felt fuzzy. "I can meet you at the 7-Eleven down the street from my apartment." She poured that rich, creamy laughter into my ear again. "Tell you what, give me an extra hour or so to go home, get a nice hot bath, make myself all pretty, and then I'll be there in your arms. Sound good for you?" "Well, okay." She laughed again and didn't say goodbye before disconnecting. Murphy appeared again, and as soon as I'd hung up the phone, "Tell me you didn't just make a date, Dresden." "You're jealous," Murphy snorted. "Please, I need more of a man than you to keep me happy." She started to get an arm underneath me and help me up. "You break like a dry stick, Dresden. You better get to bed before you get any more delusions." I put a hand against her shoulder to push her back. I didn't have that kind of strength, but she backed off, frowning. "What?" "Something," I said. I rubbed my eyes. Something was bothering me. I was forgetting something. I was sure of it. Something I had said I would do on Saturday. I struggled to push thoughts of drug wars and people driven mad by third sight visions given them by three-eye drug and tried to concentrate. It didn't take long to click. Monica. I had told her I would get in contact with her. I patted at my duster pocket until I found a notepad and took it out, fumbled it open, and waved at Murphy. "Candle. Need to read something." "Christ, Dresden, I swear you're at least as bad as my first husband. He was stubborn enough to kill himself, too." She sighed and brought a candle over. The light hurt my eyes for a moment. I made out Monica's number and I dialed her up. "Hello?" a male child's voice answered. "Hi," I said. "I need to speak to Monica, please." "Who's this?" I remembered. I was working for her on the sly and answered, "Her fourth cousin, Harry, from Vermont." "Kay," the kid said. "Hold on." Then he screamed, without lowering the mouthpiece of the phone from his lips, "Mom! Your cousin Harry from Vermont is on the phone long distance!"
Kids. You gotta love them. I adore children. A little salt, a little squeeze of lemon. Perfect. I waited for the pounding in my head to resolve into a mere agony until the kid dropped the phone and ran off, feet thumping on the hardwood floor. A moment later, there was a rattle of the phone being picked up, and Monica's quiet, somewhat nervous voice said, hello? It's Harry Dresden, I told her. I just wanted to call you and let you know what I've been able to find out for you. I'm sorry, she interrupted. I don't need any of those. I blinked. Monica Sells? I read her the phone number. Yes, yes, she said, her voice hurried, impatient. We don't need any help, thank you. Is this a bad time? No, it's not that. I just wanted to cancel my order. Discontinue the service. Don't worry about me. There was an odd quality to her voice, as though she were forcing a housewife's good cheer into it. Cancel? You don't want me looking for your husband anymore? But, ma'am, the money. The phone began to buzz, and static made the line fuzzy. I thought I heard a voice in the background somewhere, and then the sound went dead except for the static. For a moment, I thought I'd lost the connection entirely. Blasted unreliable phones. Usually they messed up on my end, not the receiving end. You can't even trust them to foul up dependably. Hello, hello, I said, cross and grumpy. Monica's voice returned. Don't worry about that. Thank you so much for all of your help. Good day. Bye-bye. Thank you. Then she hung up on me. I took the phone away from my ear and stared at it. Bizarre, I said. Come on, Harry, Murphy said. She took the phone from my hand and planted it firmly in his cradle. Oh, Mom, it's not even dark yet. I made the lame joke to try to think about something besides how terribly my head was going to hurt when Murphy helped me up. She did. It did. We hobbled me into the bedroom, and when I stretched out on the cool sheets, I was reasonably certain I was going to set down roots. Murphy took my temperature and felt my scalp with her fingers, careful around the goose egg on the back of my skull. She shined a pen light into my eyes, which I did not like. She also got me a drink of water, which I did like, and had me swallow a couple of aspirin or Tylenol or something. I only remember two more things about that morning. One was Murphy stripping me out of my shirt, boots, and socks, and leaning down to kiss my forehead and ruffle my hair. Then she covered me up with blankets and put out the lights. Mister crawled up there and laid down across my legs, purring like a small diesel engine, comforting. The second thing I remember was the phone ringing again. Murphy was just about to leave, her car keys rattling in her hand. I heard her turn back to pick up the phone and say, Harry Dresden's residence. Then there was silence. Hello, Murphy said. After another pause, Murphy appeared in the doorway, a small shadowy figure looking down on me. Wrong number. Get some rest, Harry.
Thanks, Karen.
I smiled at her, or tried to. It must have looked ghastly. She smiled back, and I'm sure hers was nicer than mine. She left then. The apartment got dark and quiet. Mister continued to rumble soothingly in the dark.
It kept nagging at me, even as I fell asleep. What had I forgotten? And another less sensible question, who had been on the line who hadn't wanted to speak to Murphy? Had Monica Sells tried to call me back? Why would she call off the case and tell me just to keep the money? I pondered this, and baseball bats, and other matters, until Mister's purring put me to sleep.
Please insert the next CD to continue this story.
I woke up when thunder rattled the old house above me. True dark had fallen. I had no idea of what time it was. I lay in the bed for a moment, confused and a little dizzy. There was a warm spot on my legs, where Mister had been until a few moments before. But the big gray cat was nowhere to be seen. He was a chicken about thunderstorms. Rain was coming down in sheets. I could hear it on the concrete outside and on the old building above me. It creaked and swayed in the spring thunderstorms and wind, timbers gently flexing, wise enough with age to give a little, rather than put up stubborn resistance until they broke. I could probably stand to learn something from that. My stomach was growling. I got out of bed, wobbled a little, and rooted about for my robe. I couldn't find it in the dark, but came across my duster where Murphy had left it on the chair, neatly folded. Laying on top of it was a scattering of cash, along with a napkin bearing the words, You will pay me back, Murphy. I scowled at the money and tried to ignore the flash of gratitude I felt. I picked up my duster and tugged it on over my bare chest, then padded on naked feet out into the living room. Thunder rumbled again, growled.